Police Court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. I'm Ed Gill. I represent Brian Fritzinger on this appeal from his convictions in from Sussex County Superior Court. This case arose when two children who were in foster care made allegations that Mr. Fritzinger had sexually abused them in many different ways over a significant period of time. Mr. Fritzinger was the mother of these two girls' boyfriend. At the time they made the allegations, the ex-boyfriend. After the girls had been to family court and been told that their half-sister, who resided with Mr. Fritzinger, would not be allowed to come live with them because, of course, the little sister had a parent who was able to care for that child, the girls made these allegations, and that started this whole ball rolling. The allegations in the trial and throughout the process were completely uncorroborated. There's never been any forensic evidence to back this up, physical evidence to back this up, or corroborating evidence from any witness, despite the fact, besides the two girls, despite the fact that these girls claimed that the sexual abuse occurred.
Mr. Gill, I think it would be helpful, to me at least, if you could just tell us what precisely your claims of error are in one sentence or two, so that we can focus on what the issues are that are before us.
Yes, sir. The reason I'm trying to give a little more background is the closeness of the case.
We've read the briefs.
Deals with all of these issues. Claims of error deal initially with the overall process, with a trial judge who presided over this case having a personal link to one of the complaining witnesses, who's the trial judge whose sister-in-law had been raped by the same person who had raped one of these complaining witnesses on a previous occasion.
You're talking about the denial of a motion to recuse?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, what's the issue that you're alluding to then?
The trial judge, who was attorney general at the time of that prior prosecution, her sister-in-law was raped by a man by the name of Marvin Dallas. Mr. Dallas was apprehended. The probable cause affidavit is in the appendix to the opening brief in this case. In this trial, there was the same chief investigating officer as there was in Mr. Dallas's case, Detective Timothy Conway of the Delaware State Police. In this case, one of the complaining witnesses was MS. And MS was previously raped by the same person who had raped the trial judge's sister-in-law. I did not know that throughout the entire trial process.
What's the error that you're claiming?
Yeah, the error that I'm claiming is that there is at least an appearance of impropriety in this judge sitting on this case. This judge did not disclose even that had occurred, that in fact the same person who had raped her sister-in-law had raped one of the complaining witnesses, and that personal link was never disclosed.
Okay, so your first claim then is that the court erroneously denied your side's motion to recuse herself?
No, sir, because I made a motion for recusal based
solely. Well, what is your argument? I mean, what is the error? What did the court not do or do that it shouldn't have done as a consequence of this same person raping sister-in-law of the judge and one of the complaining witnesses?
The trial court and the state had that knowledge throughout the trial process. The defense did not.
Well, there's where I have question I think is important to that issue, if it is an issue. As I recall, we went back to the record to find out just what information might have come to the attention of the trial judge that might cause her to sua sponte recuse herself. And as I recall it, and correct me if I may well be wrong, all we were able to determine was the perpetrator's name was Marvin. And as you pointed out, you're inferring that the trial judge would have remembered that the same chief investigating officer was involved in Marvin's rape of the sister-in-law, as was involved in the case over which she presided. But as I understand the record, that's all we know. And if there's more, tell me what it is that would raise an issue in the trial judge's mind about whether she should do the Lose analysis, the two-prong analysis of whether she should recuse herself, because we all recognize you didn't have an opportunity to make a motion to recuse because you didn't know about it. So what should we infer from the facts about the extent to which the trial judge should have, under the standard that's very clear in this state, considered recusing herself and making a record of why she did or did not?
To be completely clear on the record, I made a motion for recusal only based upon the fact that the same chief investigating officer was the chief investigating officer in this trial, in the Fritzinger trial. That was on day two of the trial. What the additional evidence, beyond what Your Honor's recollection is there, is that day one, we didn't have a jury. We dealt with the admissibility of other evidence of sexual abuse of the complaining witnesses, and we heard a motion that day. And the trial judge had a DVD of the complaining witness discussing that other sexual abuse, a DVD which I still, as I stand here today, have not seen. It was sealed. Now, I know since we had panel argument in this case back in June, this court requested that the DVD be sent up here. We received that. Both parties received notification of that. That still didn't afford me an opportunity to see that. I don't know whether the court reviewed that. But on that DVD, as described by the trial judge in trial, and known to that trial judge at the time of my narrow motion for recusal, at that time, the judge described the conduct which the person allegedly, how the person allegedly abused one of the complaining witnesses. It is our belief that that complaining witness was not a stranger rape that occurred with regards to Marvin Dallas. And I would find it extremely difficult, if not highly unlikely, to believe that a trained CAC investigator who's questioning a alleged victim of a rape would not at least ask, well, who was the person? The trial judge heard that. The trial judge heard that tape before making a ruling on my narrow motion for recusal, and obviously heard that before the entire jury trial process took place. The state knew about this because the same chief investigating officer sat at the table throughout the entire process, right next to the prosecutor, and actually testified, obviously, as a witness in the case of Barr. But no one ever brought that to the attention. So the specific error, what should have occurred, is, number one, this should have been disclosed. If it wasn't a problem whatsoever, it should have at least been disclosed to the defense so that, if appropriate, an appropriate motion could have been made. And if it had, in fact, been disclosed, the trial judge, because of her personal link, because of the empathy, the sympathy that she would have understandably had towards the complaining witness.
Is the argument that the trial judge erred by not recusing herself sua sponte because she knew that Marvin had raped her former sister-in-law and also one of the complaining witnesses? Is that the argument?
And not disclosing that, and also the state not disclosing that, because the state knew that. There's no doubt that the state knew that and did not.
Yeah, but your appeal is from error made by the trial judge, not error made by the state. What is the error made by the trial judge? That's all I've been asking.
The error made by the trial judge is, one, not revealing that this link occurred, because certainly there could have, and I believe should have been, an argument made for recusal, and two, then after having reveal that information, recusing herself, because system of justice cannot stand if we don't have not only no impropriety as far as a trial judge, but
your
no, no appearance
assumes
of impropriety.
It assumes recognition by the trial judge of the connection.
Not necessarily. And again, it's our position that certainly the facts would indicate that the trial judge should have recognized this. This is a rape of your sister.
Only a first name?
No, Your Honor, and respectfully, I still have not heard or watched that tape.
Well, and the answer to Justice Ridgely's question, at least as I understand it now, is you don't know whether the full name was on the tape or not. You don't know exactly what the trial judge heard. And your point is, whatever it was she understood, she should have disclosed it so you could determine whether or not to bring a more fulsome motion to recuse. And in any event, she should have said, I'm not recusing myself for the following reasons, or I am recusing myself for the following reasons, tracking her obligation under Loos, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And actually, my answer to Justice Ridge's question is no, because even if this DVD didn't reveal anything about the identity, and I find it very difficult to believe, of Marvin Dallas, that just that some unknown person.
And assume hypothetically just said Marvin.
Well, I think that should have provided a link when you have the same chief investigating officer, you have the same area as geographic area as to where this actually occurred. That should have at least caused further inquiry. But I'm willing to go further. Even if it was no Marvin, although I clearly articulated that to the trial judge that it was a Marvin, the appearance of impropriety which has arisen here in this case based upon this trial judge. When you have a trial judge with a personal link to what is perceived as one side of the case, I don't know how a system of justice can be perceived to be properly functioning. When you have a trial judge who referred to the complaining witnesses after every piece of evidence had been in, after pretty much argument was over, as victims, much worse than a witness, much worse than a prosecutor.
Mr. Gill, you have two other claims of error, do you not?
Yes, and the victim is one of those, is one of the claims of error, Your Honor.
Can you articulate the next claim of error?
Yes, well, that the trial judge referred to the complaining witnesses in her instruction to the jury as victims. And, in fact, earlier in the trial, when one of the complaining witnesses was testifying, told that witness, a child, in front of the jury that, well, there's some things you may know, when this child had just given her opinion about whether rape victims would report or not report, there's some things you may know which you can't tell the jury, giving that witness a buttressed credibility and also leading the jury to believe that there may be other things that those witnesses know, which the defense, by objecting, was preventing the jury from hearing.
So that was an impermissible comment on the evidence?
Yes.
The judge?
Yes, and also in violation of this court's rulings regarding reference to terminology of victim.
What court's rulings about reference to terminology of victims? What rulings are you talking about?
This court's, Your Honor.
How do you construe those rulings? As they would apply to a situation where someone's clearly a victim of a crime by someone, and the only issue is whether it's the defendant in this case or not, and a case where the entire case turns on whether the complaining witnesses are victims at all or not. Is there a distinction between the two?
There absolutely is a distinction. Sure, if someone's a clerk in a store and a robbery takes place and there's no dispute whatsoever the robbery took place, identification is the issue. A reference to the clerk, the person who's robbed as a victim, is in no way prejudicial. I would imagine the defense is going to, unless in some way it's contested.
Right, why is this case distinctive in your view?
Because that is the entire issue for the jury to decide as to whether or not these children were victims. Whether there's no question of identity, as I indicated beforehand, Mr. Fritzinger lived with these children's mother.
So in this case, your argument is based on the absence of any physical or objective medical evidence that these children were sexually assaulted.
Well, that's part of it, and that goes into, as I'll talk about, the Rape Shield statute.
How can it be part of it? The Chief Justice just identified the distinction, and what we've said in our prior cases is if a child was clearly sexually assaulted, the child is clearly a victim, and can be referred to as a victim, and we simply want to identify the perpetrator. I thought your argument in this case is there was no objective evidence that either of these complaining witnesses were victims.
Correct.
All right, what's the point of using the word partial in response to my question?
Well, that's not the, again, because identity, I think, is the big, if identity, as Your Honor indicated, if there was no dispute that these children or a child had been sexually abused, but just the identity was the issue, it wouldn't be an issue regarding the use of the word victim. It probably was not the appropriate thing, appropriate terminology to use, but the prejudice wouldn't be there. And when it comes out of the trial judge's mouth and instructing the jury, that heightens the prejudice, particularly after all the evidence had been submitted.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understood your answer to Justice Holland's question. Is it your position that the two complaining witnesses were sexually abused or that they weren't?
We're not. In moving through the other errors, there also was clear violation of Rule 16 discovery and the order of the Superior Court of April 8th of 2009. The state, as I indicated before, these children were in foster care, were in the custody of the state throughout the entire process, throughout all relevant times to this case. Sane examinations to determine or attempt to determine whether they had been sexually abused were done of both of these girls. On TS, the sane examination was not turned over until months afterwards, but arguably in enough time for the defense to prepare for trial. The sane examination of MS was not turned over to the defense until the Friday before a Monday trial, leaving us with absolutely no time to go ahead and prepare with regards to that. And in fact, the sane examination of MS was videotaped. And that videotape still has not been turned over to the defense, but was not even revealed to exist to the defense until the fifth or sixth day of trial, when the state sought to introduce some evidence from a nurse examiner regarding this.
Did you seek a continuance on that Monday morning, having gotten the sane report on Friday?
I filed a motion for dismissal and argued that before the court at some length. And the argument regarding that is contained in the motion there.
It would be fair to say the answer to Justice Berger's question is no.
I don't recall as a secondary position if the dismissal was not granted that we requested a continuance of the matter. Mr. Fritzinger had been in this trial took place in June of 2009. Trial had been once continued already on April 8th due to the state's discovery violations. Mr. Fritzinger had been incarcerated since October of the previous year. So he had approximately 8 months of his life already spent in prison as a result of the charges against him without being convicted of anything.
Mr. Gill,
I don't recall the answer to that. Yes.
I'm just trying to connect some dots here. You've made the point that a tape, a second tape of a second interview wasn't produced to you until the Friday before the Monday that the trial was supposed to begin, right?
No, I misspoke as far as that. The tape that I'm referring to is the second tape is the tapes.
I'm just asking.
I'm trying to
relate that to a claim of error. I mean, tell me what the claim of error is, and then tell us what the relevance is of the late production of the tape, if that is what happened.
Well, that is what happened. That's what's clear. And the tape is actually of the physical examination of MS. That's the tape that was produced to me the fifth or sixth day of trial, as we were actually well into the trial. The report of MS, sane examination, was not produced for me until the Friday before a Monday trial date in this case, second trial date. Now, we argued this case before the panel, and after that, this court ordered the parties to have supplemental briefing on an ALR fourth article regarding the rape shield statute. And I want to use, hopefully remain time unless there's any additional questions on those areas to deal with that.
You're claiming a violation of the rape shield law?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And what is the relevance? What is the claim of violation, and how does the late production of that tape fit into the claim?
The relevance of the...
Well, tell us first what the claim is, and then tell me the relevance of it.
Well, the claim is that the trial court refused to allow the defendant to submit evidence regarding alternative sources of sexual knowledge of these two children.
I thought with regard to the older child, the court specifically told the jury that there had been prior incidents involving other people.
The court allows a very limited question.
That happened, didn't it?
Yes, that for purposes of credibility purposes, because at the end of her first CAC tape, MS, the older girl, indicated that she had never been sexually abused prior to this. She was asked the question. Then on the tape, which I still have not seen, she apparently detailed sexual abuse by two other people.
So my question is a lot simpler than that. You just told us you weren't allowed to show prior knowledge through other contact. My question was, with regard to the older child, you were allowed to show, you were allowed to let the jury know there had been prior contact with other people.
But that was the extent of it. I was not allowed at all to go into detail. The allegations in this case are lurid in detail. You had these children talking about penile vaginal sex.
Now, we've all read the record.
Yes, I mean, all different types of sex, and I was not allowed to go ahead and bring out what this child was claiming had occurred with regards to the other people. So, no, I was not allowed to go ahead and present that evidence that occurred. Mainly, I was allowed to go ahead and bring it out for purposes of credibility. She said one thing here. She said something else an hour later in the second tape. That's basically why the trial judge allowed that out. But Your Honor is correct that specific question, one specific question, had you been previously sexually abused, was allowed to be asked of MS.
Mr. Gill, one thing would be helpful to me is, would you articulate your argument about how the statute was violated because the trial judge did not hold a hearing that's mandated by 11 Delaware Code Section 3508? I'm not really familiar with the process that talks about in the statute. So as I understand it, you made an offer of proof. The trial judge determined solely from your offer of proof that there was some relevant testimony, and you were allowed in her mind to present what she thought was relevant, but that the statute calls for her to hold a hearing, which she never held. Is that your claim of error?
There was more. The trial judge also...
Well, let me rephrase the question then. Is that a claim of error, that she didn't hold the hearing called for by the statute?
Yes. Although, if the offer of proof is not sufficient, as the statute reads, the trial judge does not have to hold a hearing if everything else that she has gone ahead and seen up to that point in time. So what occurred...
Well, that's my question. I'm trying to determine whether this statute mandates a hearing, irrespective of the trial judge's assessment of your offer of proof. Must she nevertheless go ahead and hold a hearing?
No, I don't argue that. I don't argue that, Your Honor. What I do argue is that, and to try to sum it into a sentence or two, is that when these children were making these detailed allegations of sexual abuse, and the jury was left with a false impression that the only way they would know about this, these detailed things, came from the contact with the defendant in this case, the defendant should have been allowed, as the ALR article indicates, is allowed in the vast majority of jurisdictions, to introduce evidence of an alternative source of the sexual knowledge of these complaining witnesses. And that's my two-sentence or very long run-on sentence summary of what this argument is. Delaware, our statute, this court has not, while it's given some procedural guidance in past cases, it has not gone on and given the type of Pulzano, as the Wisconsin Supreme Court analysis has stated. And the ALR article places Delaware, although, again, it doesn't specifically mention the Delaware statute, into the broadest type of cases. We don't delineate in our statute. It can be introduced for purposes of proving prior false complaints, things such as the Wisconsin statute goes ahead and articulates. So all we need is relevance and not otherwise inadmissible. So we are in the broadest category of cases is what our legislature.
Mr. Gill, I'm sorry to have to tell you, but you're out of time, including your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice. Justices Paul Wallace on behalf of the state.
Mr. Wallace, if it's not too disconcerting, could you begin with explaining to us how the Rape Shield statute is supposed to operate? What is the relationship between the offer of proof or the proffer and the statute calling for a hearing on relevancy?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think this Court has addressed that before, either in the Wright or the Franklin case. I'm not exactly sure which case, but 35083 suggests that the first thing that must happen is that there must be a written motion. That written motion must have an affidavit in the form of an offer of proof. What is the specific evidence that the person intends to offer? Here, the affidavit was an affidavit by Mr. Gill simply complaining about discovery and trying to say, look, we still think there's more out there. It was much more of a fishing expedition, as it has been throughout.
What must the written motion contain?
I believe it needs to contain specifics as to what is the evidence that you intend to offer, what is your firm, sworn averments that evidence actually exists, and what it will prove. A form of offer of proof would seem to have to.
And if we accept the Wisconsin Supreme Court's rationale, it would have to address those factors as well.
Yes. Yes, and in fact, the first three factors in the Wisconsin test talk about that its prior abuse clearly occurred, or that there was prior conduct that clearly occurred, and some specifics as to it. But, Your Honor,
how would someone know that at the time of this trial if we had not adopted the Wisconsin rationale? Yeah, assuming we adopted it in this case.
I think that the court had given some guidance. As I said, 35083 specifically says that unless that offer of proof is sufficient, the court need not address it. And excuse me if I'm getting the cases wrong. Either Whiteman or Wright or Franklin, one of those three 3508 cases specifically, in at least two of them, the court spoke to the fact that that offer of proof was insufficient in that case. So certainly there was illustration of what was
Subsection 3 says if the offer of proof is sufficient. It doesn't say in whole or in part. It just says if it's sufficient, which gives a lot of room for its level of sufficiency, I would think. The court shall hold a hearing and give the defendant an opportunity to cross-examine, in effect, or question anyway, the complaining witness. Yeah. Since some evidence was allowed, is it arguable here that the trial judge found that the offer of proof was sufficient, at least in part? And if so, why was no hearing held?
I think what the trial judge did is what a trial judge must do in trying to make that sufficiency determination. If the court looks to the record, there were three things that the defense tried to say, we should get past the Rape Shield law because we have three theories of possible admissibility of sexual conduct or sexual abuse of these victims before. One was their knowledge of sexual activity. And I'll discuss that, if I may, in discussing the ALR. The second theory was, quote, some problems with the same examination. That was never fleshed out. The judge did have a hearing with the attorneys and said, look, explain to me where you're getting to. That one was never even discussed. And then lastly, there was a complaint that, or a suggestion that this evidence of prior sexual conduct will show that they've made false allegations before and know how to manipulate the system. That's what the motion itself said. If you go to the appendix, A61 through 82, the judge spends a great deal of time with Mr. Gill trying to get him to articulate what is it that tells you, where is the evidence that, in fact, there were false allegations before and that these girls knew how to manipulate the system from that. And he failed utterly. And the judge found that. I suggest that that's exactly what a trial judge should be doing. That is fleshing it out first, beforehand. Now, there was the suggestion then, because 3508 goes directly to credibility. And that's what their 3508 and 3509 articulate two different reasons that one might be able to get prior sexual conduct in. One is credibility under 3508. The other is 3509 that talks about evidence because it may go to consent or a defense of consent. That's not at issue here. When the judge, when the defense claimed this goes to credibility, the judge did look at the evidence that was there and said, you are correct, to the extent that at the end of the first statement, MS told the CAC investigator, no, I've never, something like this has never happened before, I've never been abused or touched improperly before, and then says, that's not true, I have been. And then that leads to the second CAC interview. The judge particularly allowed questioning on that area because that, even if 3508 was fully fallen out, goes to credibility.
Allowed questioning at what stage of the proceeding?
In the cross-examination of MS at trial. Yes.
Not a separate hearing that subsection 3 talks about.
No, the judge didn't even have it.
The answer then is, even if the affidavit is partially sufficient, the trial judge has the abuse of discretion review call on whether to actually hold a hearing or not, even though the statute says they shall order a hearing?
I think it's an abuse of discretion as to whether or not there's sufficiency, Your
Honor.
But
where I'm troubled. The statute says if the offer of proof is sufficient, it doesn't say in whole or in part or for to what extent, then it says the court shall order a hearing.
Yes.
Now, we know there was no hearing.
Yes.
So if the affidavit was in part sufficient because the judge allowed some questioning based on the affidavit's suggestion of relevance at the trial, why wasn't there a hearing?
Well, the problem here is what hearing need be made? The judge could make the full determination right then and there just with the attorney without trying to put the child on to then talk about prior sexual conduct.
But the full determination is the sufficiency of the affidavit to move forward and allow more fulsome questioning. And the place for that more fulsome questioning is outside the presence of the jury at a separate hearing that was never held.
Again, Your Honor, the court went further than just the hearing with counsel and trying to get them to flesh it out. Actually, the judge then looked at the second CAC interview to try to get from said to Mr. Gill, what is it you're looking for?
But hearing isn't talking about a chamber's conference or a conference outside the presence of the jury with the lawyers. The hearing 3508.3 contemplates is an opportunity for defense counsel, after a sufficient showing, to actually ask questions of the complaining witness outside the presence of the jury, giving defense counsel an opportunity to flesh out whether there's really anything to the complaining witness's past sexual conduct or whatever the relevant issue may be.
But I suppose here's the issue in this particular case, Your Honor. There is clearly evidence from the first CAC tape that the child gave an incorrect answer and then corrected herself. That was clear on the record. The judge didn't have to have any type of hearing, and actually that doesn't go to prior sexual conduct. That goes to a specific answer.
But maybe I'm wrong, but as I read subsection 3, it's not about the judge having a hearing. It's about giving the defense counsel the opportunity to ask questions before trial outside the presence of the jury. And then the trial judge will be able to rule on the scope of the admissibility of the answers. But without the hearing, defense counsel never gets to flesh out the issue.
Not if he doesn't prove that there is a sufficient, that the allegation or the offer is sufficient for that area of questioning. And that area of questioning is actually questioning the child about prior sexual conduct, or the judge herself determined from the offer of proof that there was no sufficiency to delve into the actual nature of the conduct itself, but that in fact only from the offer of proof that she could make a determination right then and there that he could at very least ask the question about giving an improper answer
now,
at one time.
I understand about allowing him at trial to within the limited scope that she found relevant to ask questions, but there's a gap there contemplated by the statute, and that gap was never filled here because there was never a hearing in between to give him, in effect, discovery, in effect, an opportunity to explore the complaining witness's relevant testimony. That was cut off.
But I believe, Your Honor, that's because the judge made the finding that the actual allowing him to ask the question about didn't you give an answer that wasn't correct, the CAC interviewer, isn't necessarily, quote, 3508 prior sexual conduct testimony. The judge just found that's a relevant inquiry due to credibility under the other rules. Then we go to the, is there a sufficient showing that he should be able to question this child about the child's actual sexual conduct or actual sexual experiences before? And the judge found that was insufficient. For 3508 purposes, that was insufficient because, one, when he claimed that it would show that she made false allegations against other people and knew how to manipulate the process, he wasn't able to articulate that at all, and there was no showing of that at all. As to the same allegation, there wasn't that at all, and that left the one last area. And the one last area was whether or not he could overcome the rape shield law to prove knowledge of sexual activity. So I suggest that the questioning that the judge did allow wasn't one that was required by 3508 or because she found sufficiency in 3508 terms. 3508 terms are specifically to, can I ask this child about her actual experiences before? What the judge found was, no, you cannot ask this child. You haven't made a sufficient showing that you should be able to ask this child about what she has experienced before.
Okay,
but
so you're arguing that the evidence that, or the proffer itself never got past the basic threshold, and therefore there was no entitlement to a hearing.
Yes.
Is that your position?
Yes. But in the course of I'm sorry.
As I understood it, the older child denied any prior inappropriate contact with anyone and then changed her mind. Is that correct?
Yes. At the end of her CAC interview, that's what occurred.
So then the question under the statute is triggered regarding credibility. And what Mr. Gill is saying is the state shouldn't be able to make the argument that her only knowledge was from the charged conduct because, in fact, there had been prior conduct. And the problem of not having a hearing is that if he was going to further challenge the credibility, he needed to know about what specific knowledge was developed in the prior conduct that might be similar to this conduct. So I think that's the thrust of the Chief Justice's question. Why wasn't there a hearing once there was a proper proffer that credibility was at issue by the older child's own admission that permitted the defense to find out the source of any existing knowledge?
Well, I think, again, it's mixing two areas of relevance here. The child's giving an improper answer one time speaks to truthfulness in that regard. But actually putting in evidence of her prior abuse, actually questioning the child herself about that in a hearing, is a different inquiry. And that inquiry is, will evidence of that further the defense in the way that he wishes to? And then I think we get directly into what the ALR article talks about and what the standard should be for that. And I think the judge appropriately applied the standard here.
Wait. I'm not sure you know, how the statute is supposed to work under that interpretation. Justice Holland was suggesting is that at least in part, the offer of proof was found to be sufficient because it went directly to the credibility of one of the complaining witness's statements. That being the case, the statute commanded that there had to be a hearing. It may be a valid question, what purpose would that hearing serve? The Chief Justice suggested that it would serve the same purpose as an in limine hearing to determine whether in a dress rehearsal, so to speak, outside the presence of the jury, a cross-examination of the child, that there really would be a contradiction that could be developed. If there would be, then presumably that evidence would be used at trial. If not, then perhaps it wouldn't be. Is that a correct view of the way the statute's supposed to operate? And if that didn't happen, why don't we have error here?
I do not believe that it is a correct view, Your Honor. And the reason I don't believe it's a correct view is this. Giving an improper answer to any question is relevant. There's no doubt about that. And a person's prior, quote, dishonest act in giving an improper answer or giving a lie, if that's what we wanted to call it, can be questioned, no matter what the subject matter is. But the Rape Shield statute goes to a specific area.
And this particular tape, that is the statement that was made and the arguably inconsistent statement that was made in the second tape went to that area that's contemplated by the statute, did it not? Prior sexual experience.
Yes. But the prior sexual experience is whether or not, under what defense counsel wanted to admit it for. Defense counsel wanted to admit it, and his offer of proof, to show that these children had knowledge that came from areas other than molestation by Brian Fritzinger. And when he does that, then in fact, what must happen is he has to make an offer of proof, and it has to be admissible under the terms of the LLR article. And I'd suggest respectfully that no matter whether you use Wisconsin's formulation of the test or you use some other formulation of the test, the end of the Wisconsin test, the beginning of the test that we suggest is there, is a heightened or a sharpened relevancy.
Well, I understand from that response is that perhaps defense counsel made the wrong relevance argument. That is, the right relevance argument would have been, this complaining witness testified that, or on the tape, told someone that she'd had no prior sexual experience. The second tape showed that, in fact, she had, and that falls right within the ambit of the statute, does it not? That is, if that had been the way the matter had been presented to the court.
I don't know that it fully does, and the reason is this, because whether or not, whatever the experience had been the question asked at the end of the first tape is, has anybody else ever touched you inappropriately or something to that effect? And she first says no, and then says, no, that's not true. I have. That has happened. And then she's questioned. They had that evidence. They were able to specifically ask her about that. And in fact, quite honestly, Your Honor, they had the best of all worlds, because what they could do and what they did with MS was say, you were asked whether or not you were abused, weren't you? And you were untruthful at that. You claim that, in fact, you've been abused by two other people.
So what you're arguing, and I gather, is that even if there was some violation of the procedure that's laid out in the statute, it doesn't matter because it was harmless. It was harmless because the same the cross-examination took place anyway before the jury.
The cross-examination that could be, and that is, didn't you give a prior inconsistent answer here? And overlaid with that is, the very evidence that would have been violative of the Rape Shield Act, and that is that you had been prior abused on a prior occasion, okay, left open to...
Wallace, let me ask you a question so I can understand your position on the scope of the Rape Shield law. Let's assume a hypothetical where a witness overhears a child talking to another child. Let's falsely complain, or let's file a false complaint about our stepfather, saying that he did to us what our foster brother did to us, or did to me, and which was a sexual crime. Is that admissible or not under the Rape Shield law, and the details of what the foster brother did under those circumstances?
I suggest that could be. Certainly, because that goes directly to credibility. That is a witness saying, I heard them make up a plan to falsely accuse and to use facts from some other incident to place into this jury, to place into their story regarding the father.
Well, can I interrupt you for a second?
Yes.
Because I think the way you're answering Justice Ridgely is that you're basically taking over the function of the judge. You're saying, oh yeah, that would be more relevant, so that more information could come in if that hypothetical had been what happened. And I think what the questions from the court have been focusing on is that isn't that exactly why there's supposed to be a hearing, so then the judge hears what is all the detail of what the prior experience was and how similar it was to this, these allegations and so on, and then the trial judge gets to make a decision weighing the evidence and so forth as to how much, if any, of that is going to come in to the trial. And you're saying, well, he got all he needed here because he got to put before the jury the fact that there were allegations of prior abuse, and so therefore the jury could understand that that's where they knew about all these sexual activities as opposed to knowing about it from this defendant. But the judge never got into what the prior experiences had been and therefore never made a ruling about, well, you can ask a little bit more about this because this is almost identical. And it's so close that it suggests that they are perhaps making up a replay of what happened in a different case.
I disagree under the facts of this case, Your Honor, because part of that initial determination as to whether or not the offer of proof was sufficient was the judge actually reviewing the second tape to determine, based on what you are claiming, that is, that this would show some evidence of what the Massachusetts court call extraordinary knowledge of sexual matters. And I think if you look in the ALR article, by the way, he doesn't hit any of these. Age isn't in his favor because the children were older. Similarity doesn't because it is dissimilar. MS is the only one who had, there were any claims of prior sexual knowledge. This transferred knowledge to TS because MS may have been abused. Nobody buys that. There's no jurisdiction that's ever held that. So what the judge did in this case was, in that first step of determining whether the offer of proof was sufficient, she had the tape to know exactly what may be out there and what may be able to be put in, looked at it, determined that it was not similar. In fact, there is, on the record, she said, well, it's dissimilar. You're claiming that because she says when there was penile vaginal intercourse, there was pain at one point but not pain later on, that shows some advanced knowledge and that he should be able to ask questions about that. She said, but the tape and what she claims was just digital or oral penetration by other people. So they don't match up. That similarity isn't there. He then tries to move on and say, well, but because MS had circumstances where there was oral penetration, and TS describes in detail what oral penetration must be, I should be able to ask about MS's stuff because they share a room and obviously talked about this.
But the logical extension of your argument is that once you satisfy the threshold with your affidavit, so in this case, inconsistent statements going to credibility, that rather than a hearing called for under the statute, that the complaining witness should be examined in camera by the judge. And after the judge concludes there's need to go further, you go further. And if the judge concludes and there's no need to go further, you don't go any further.
No, Your Honor, that respectfully, that's not what I would suggest. I would suggest that in exercising the court's discretion in determining whether or not there's a sufficient offer of proof or whether or not this evidence would be there, the judge should be able to use whatever may be at the judge's disposal to do so. Understanding what the meaning and the purpose behind the rape shield statute is to begin with, not to put a child up in a courtroom to be asked about these things.
We all understand that. My question for you is, if there's an acknowledged credibility problem, what do you have to do to have a hearing?
I think if there's an acknowledged credibility problem that goes directly to the nature of the prior conduct the child has been exposed to, you need to be able to say in particular terms what that is. He would have failed utterly here because he wouldn't have made it as to age, he wouldn't have made it as to similarity of acts, he wouldn't have made it at all. And I think the judge made the proper determination of that with those matters at her disposal.
I know you're out of time, but I do want to ask you one question before you sit down about the alleged Rule 16 violation. Understanding that application has to be made to a Superior Court judge to remedy any defect in the Rule 16 discovery, why in this case did the discovery come piecemeal to the defense, with some of it arriving after the trial had already begun?
But, Your Honor, here's why. First of all, if we're talking about the sane examinations themselves, T.S.'s sane examination, she had a sane examination regarding these allegations, and that was turned over. What happened was nobody was aware, even the prosecutor wasn't aware, that actually during T.S.'s examination, there was also videotaping of the examination done. That was found out during trial. That was found out when the nurse practitioner, I believe, was there.
Well, how can that happen? How can the prosecutor not have interviewed, for purposes of a trial, the interviewer and find out it was being videotaped?
I honestly, Your Honor, I think it happened very, very easily, because in all of my time as a prosecutor, I never knew that anybody ever videotaped a sane examination. I think most prosecutors probably didn't know that. Because of the nature of the examinations, nobody generally makes videotapes of those things.
Doesn't Rule 16 put a burden on the prosecution to gather that information and to know whether or not it exists well before the deadline for turning over the information?
I believe it does. I'm not going to say that the state doesn't have that burden. The reality is that when the prosecutor got the sane examination and got the medical records, if there's no mention of videotape in there, quite honestly, I don't know myself as a prosecutor if I would have said to a sane nurse, did you videotape this? They take photographs, I know that, and in fact they turn over the photographs and everything else. So the reality is, in the end, first of all, T.S.'s examination was not exculpatory, and it wasn't put in.
Well,
M.S. is...
Unless Rule 16 has changed, the information identified in Rule 16 doesn't have to be exculpatory. We're not talking about Brady versus Merrill.
But I guess the point is that this is something held by the hospital, and it's a medical record, and it's not necessarily something that's in the state's control. When we ask for the sane examination and get the report and get the photographs and turn those over, it appeared that the prosecutor just simply didn't even know that it had been videotaped, and I can tell the court that that's not knowledge common. It's certainly more common now. Secondly, as to the other Rule 16 complaint made about MS's examination, MS was not examined in relation to these allegations. She was examined, there was a different sane examination done, and that's why it wasn't turned over, because it had nothing to do with these allegations. Once the defense asked for it, we obtained it. It took some period of time. But it wasn't as if MS went to the hospital, got a sane examination in relation to her abused by Fritzinger.
I understand it's not as if the prosecutor knew about it, put it in a drawer, and intentionally didn't turn it over. I understand that's not on the table. I'm just concerned about how seriously Rule 16 is being taken and the extent to which the state makes every effort to make sure they comply within a deadline, because particularly in a case where you have an incarcerated defendant and information's dribbling in before and after the deadline, defense counsel is under a terrible burden to whether or not to ask for a continuance when they have an incarcerated client, and then to respond to information that shows up that may or may not be relevant, still has to be assessed during trial, is a pretty awkward situation that reveals some horrible inefficiencies in our criminal justice system.
Your Honor, I fully understand the court's concern, and I can tell you that the Office of the Attorney General shares that concern. Prosecutors are doing their best. Take this case, for example. The prosecutor did get the examination of T.S., the one that was done in relation to this case, got whatever she knew was there. It turns out that it had also been videotaped. Did not know that when it found out. Was told immediately. It was late. I don't know that anybody would have known that. And MS's, as soon as it was asked for, it was obtained, but it was from a different case.
We appreciate the explanation. Thank you, Mr. Wallace. Take the case under advisement and recess.
Aye.